At any rate, this is Physics 113. If you don't want to be in Physics 113, now's a good time to leave. It's a physics survey course. It is designed for science majors who are not majoring in physics or engineering. I do assume some knowledge of calculus. So if you have seen integrals before, you are okay. If you have never seen an integral before, you'll probably want to fix that if you don't stay in here. That said, many people tend to blame math for difficulties in this class when the problem isn't math. It's a very conceptual class, and I'll basically be teaching you what you need to know about the calculus at some level as we go conceptually. What makes it hard is that we use calculus in a way that is not done in the math classes. In math classes, they hand you a calculus problem and you solve it. Here you actually have to understand why we use calculus and how to set it up. And the solving of it is not what I emphasize. Okay, I'll even give you the derivative or the integral during a test or whatever. That's not the issue. Okay, it's understanding it. And understanding it, unfortunately, isn't something they generally teach in your typical calculus class. Understanding the way that you typically use it. So, just be ready for that. We're going to cover lots of topics. The main theme is the mechanical world. My guess is working out the syllabus, I'll skimp a little on thermodynamics because I don't have a lot of time to do that when I was looking at the schedule. I might try to do a little bit of special relativity instead, which hopefully you guys would find fun, but we'll see. So you have to take the syllabus a little bit with a grain of salt, just because I'll modify it as we go. You know how you're doing. Many of you will have high school physics, and that's great. And many of you who have high school physics will have had a pretty good high school physics class, and that may help a good bit, okay? Many of you will come in having had a high school physics class and really not have picked up the level of understanding that is equivalent to the kinds of stuff that I'll be expecting of you. So just the main message that I want to leave here is the first few weeks of this class are going to seem pretty brain dead easy, probably. When we hit Newton's laws, most of you will be deceived into thinking that it's brain dead easy, and then you're going to find that it's really subtle, a lot more subtle than you think. So I find if I give an exam, say, 3 weeks into September, or the end of September, before we really get into Newton's laws, there's a very high mean in this class, like 85 or something. Everybody thought, cool, this is easy, and nobody studies. And then we get Newton's laws. If I give an exam 2 weeks into Newton's laws, the mean is easily 65 or below. Okay? So it's very subtle. So the message is, don't let up, just keep at it. Another piece of it is, physics requires jail time. I cannot tell you how many times, getting ready for the final, I've had a student in my class studying or asking questions and realizing what they missed on the earlier exams and being literally embarrassed by it because it is so trivial. Okay? It's like riding a bike. Everything we hit in physics, you're going to find seems difficult, seems okay. And with some time, with some playing on it, all of a sudden it will just sort of make sense. If you don't give yourself that jail time, you're in trouble. Okay? So I'm going to ask you not to cram. And I really mean that. And I mean it for your own good. Okay? This isn't the kind of stuff that cramps. I don't know why it's that way. The brain is a very weird thing. Okay? When I was in college, my calc press professor walks in and gives us 70 problems of doing integration by trigonometric substitution. Have you ever done that? 70 problems. I thought the guy was totally insane. And he basically said, do them all, get good. And of course, most of us were only going to do a few of them, but me, I was anal, so I was going to do them all. So So I sat down and I worked very hard for a couple of days and I did them all except for five. So I worked on those five for an additional day or two. And then it became nothing about the calculus, right? It was me against those stupid problems. They had pissed me off. So I worked and I worked and I worked and I worked and I was really getting exhausted about it. And then one of my buddies walks in and says, "Hey, let's go to happy hour." And I was like, "Yeah, you know, I'm totally there." And so we went off to happy hour. That's the last I remember of that night. I'm serious, I'm not actually editing it. Unfortunately, I don't remember most of that night. But the next morning, I walked into the place where I normally study, and I saw, in very shaky, not too neat handwriting, five solutions to those five problems. Well, one solution to each of those five problems, no mistakes. The handwriting was mine. It doesn't say much for my social life, but it does say something about how strange the brain is, okay? So when I tell you you need jail time, get a jail time. The moral of this story is don't go partying the night before physics exams. That probably won't work for the majority of you, okay? But just to say, the brain is really strange. If you haven't had, you know, shower experiences where you're sitting there and all of a sudden this thing you've been worrying about just pops in your head and the solution is there. I mean, I don't know. That kind of crap happens to me all the time. So physics is sort of that way. Give yourself time to study. That's one of my main messages for you today. It will make your life much easier. You should have received an email. You did? Okay. It had the syllabus attached, lots of contact info and everything like that. Did anyone not get that email? We need the syllabus. All right. So, would you do me a favor and just get that? Everybody's got their hand up. Okay, so that will give you the contact information. If you did not get the syllabus, it means something is broken between the registrar and you and me and Blackboard. And we'd like to get that fixed if we can. So I would like you to look into that. Because I will be emailing you this way, typically. Okay, and I use the email for lots of things. I will answer questions during, you know, pre-exam craziness. I will alert you to changes of rooms. I will send you corrections to crazy things I say, or whatever. All right, so you'll get lots of emails from me. Anyway, you're going to, over time, learn much more about me than any of you care to know. So I want to learn a little bit about you. I was wondering, perhaps, what is your name? Why are you black?
I'm Michael Israel. I'm actually graduated and I'm taking this class to finish my pre-dental requirements.
Very cool. Okay. Goodness. How about you?
Hi, I'm Suge and I'm taking this for my pre-dental
requirements. All right.
I'm Tyler and I'm also taking it for pre-med.
Okay. We're getting a bit of a theme here. So scared, I'm not going to ask you about your weekend. Although that was, maybe I should, you turned red.
I'm Sandoval and I'm taking this for my major.
Alright, okay. So, of course, so you're sitting in the middle, so you feel safe. And you are?
Maddie.
Hi, Maddie.
Hi.
Why are you here?
I'm taking this for my major as well.
Okay. Don't be scared. I sort of get the feeling I could ask all 200 and some of you why you're in here, and I would hear 198 answers similar to what I just heard. Not a damn one of you wants to be here. Do you have any idea how that makes me feel? So when I first Rochester, I was teaching classes like this for a while, and what you'll find is, you know, occasionally I'll get bored with what we're doing, and so I'll start telling you some story about physics, like physics in the real cool physics as opposed to, well, okay. So I say cool physics as opposed to what we're going to do, but actually a lot of what we're going to do is really beautiful, and I hope people learn to appreciate some of it. But then I taught Physics 142, which is the honors physics sequence, and I went off on some tangent, and whereas in here, when I go off on some tangent and you recognize it, I can like, just a half a pencil go down. Now, some of you will actually perk up, hopefully, because you'll actually find this more interesting than maybe something I'm doing. But many of you will disengage. So I did this for 142 the first time, and I looked up, and every student was on the edge of their seat, and it scared the crap out of me. I was like, oh my God. I now have to be very careful what I say. But okay, so that's contact information. I get the sense why you think you're here. You're sort of here because you have to be here. It is a requirement for your major. So that's fine. One message is we're actually going to have some fun in spite of that. And you might wonder why people bother making this a requirement for your major. It's not just because the MCAT has, and I'm going to apologize right now to many of you. I understand that many of you in this room have no interest whatsoever in medical school, okay? But I will still make MCAT cracks. Don't take them personally. It is true that many students in this class are potentially interested in medical school or dental school or whatever, and those exams, the entry exams, do have sections on physics. And students who do well on the sequence do well on those exams. So that is certainly one reason that we're all here. But it is also true that physics is actually fundamentally very important, and regardless of what you do in biology or medicine, you will be dealing with physical structures, things that are filled with fluids, things that have to be supported, okay? And in order to deal with those physical things, you have to understand physics, okay? And this is the basis, you'll actually find that some of what we'll do will be a nice model for chemical bonds and energy concepts and heat flow, and it will be the foundation for what you'll need for Physics 114, which basically covers the rest of what you might be needing to deal with in the medical world by and far. Because to understand chemistry, basically, you need to understand electromagnetism and quantum mechanics. And whatever you're going to be doing probably will deal with chemistry. So fundamentally, it's at the core of most of what you'll be dealing with. There's a lot more to it than that, though. I do want to give you some awareness and respect for physics and the concepts involved in physics. But to me, as sort of the professor here at U of R, I actually think that it's a much more valuable course than that. One of the ways in which it's valuable is I hope it is a way to give you some practice and some maybe help develop your skills to confront problems that when you first look at them, you don't see the answer. And you have to learn to tease them apart and pick them to pieces and pull, you know, figure out little bits and then pull them back together. And boom, there comes the answer. You also need to learn to recognize when you've got the right or the best answer. Okay, and this course is a wonderful place to practice that kind of thing. So I actually think it carries far beyond just doing physics problems. So I hope you'll keep that in mind as you have the great fun of doing some of these problem sets. Not on this list is to learn how to be a physicist. So there will be times that I will slip into the lingo. I'm pretty good about not doing that, but if I do, please just raise your hand and say, you know, what was that? And I'll regroup and rephrase it. The other thing is, I will not spend a lot of time teaching you the mathematical tricks that physicists use. Okay, so just so we're all on the same page, that's not what this course is about. If that's the kind of thing you're looking for, you belong in probably 140 series. Okay, so again, the spirit, one spirit of one of the things that I think is important about this class really is what Einstein says. It's not so much that this is a learning of many facts course. Okay, it's really a learning to be, to think, is what I'm hoping that we're really doing. In the end, I wish we could just play with this, because I actually think a lot of it's very fun. But unfortunately, in our system, we need to have evaluation. And the syllabus lays that out. The evaluation in this course is going to be done through the context of three exams and a final exam. The three exams will cover specific sections of the course. The final exam will be cumulative. This is a quantitative problem-solving course. I will mix types of problems on the exams. You'll see some multiple choice, some discussion, brief discussion, and many analytical problems, both simple and complex. So we'll have different levels. I'll be looking for different things. You may look at a problem and decide you haven't seen anything. We weren't talking about that. But then I want you to think about what it is, because it's probably a synthesis of two or three things that we were talking about. And in fact, it's, knowing and put on there is a very difficult problem, which is basically looking to see if you can do that kind of synthesis. But certainly not all the problems will be like that. There'll be some that will be exactly like, more or less what you've seen in homeworks or workshops or whatever. I do allow you one exam drop in this class. I find it's a big stress relief for you. It also has something very important for me. With a class this size, lots of people have problems with specific exam dates or emergencies come up. Okay? I understand that. So the fact that I have a drop built in means that if you have a family emergency, or if you just meet some really sweet significant other that you want to spend time with instead of study, and you decide you want to drop the exam or not take that exam, I don't want to hear about it. I don't need to hear about it. Hit your drop. Okay? I wish you well. I hope it wasn't grandma who died. I hope it's the other. Okay? But I don't need to know about it. We don't have to negotiate over email. And I do that for a reason, because I find 10% of you decide you have to negotiate with me over what's going on with that exam. I lose a week before that exam, so we're just not going to play that game. Hopefully it doesn't happen. There may be a few of you who have issues with two separate exams, okay? When that's the case, get in touch with me. I'm not going to write a makeup exam. I can't do that fairly. It takes me a week to do it, okay? But we'll work something out. I'll probably raise the fraction of your grade, which is the final. If you miss, the final, then you're just going to have to take an incomplete. Okay? Now, there is this drop, but what you might notice is the way that I do this is I will calculate your numerical grade, dropping each exam successively, and in an instance where you, and if you don't drop, if you take all the exams, well, regardless, I will be calculating also this way. It's just if you drop one of these comes in with a zero. Then I will look at the final number that I get from each of those, and I'll take the highest. So it automatically gives you the best combination. So if you drop exams, you don't show up, I'll automatically not take that particular calculation because you'll have a lower average. Okay, so you don't have to tell me which one you're dropping or whatever. But you'll also notice that if you do take them all, it's basically it gives you the option of effectively dropping the one where you had a bad day. Right? So it is to your advantage to take them all. What I really don't want to hear is if you decide, or you have an emergency and you have to drop one, and then the next one comes around and you have a bad day, then telling me that trying to negotiate that one away, that's hard to do. Okay, that's not how the system works. So just try to keep, you know, try to just skip the one that you need to skip if you have to skip one. Okay. Once I calculate your grade there is one other thing. Because of the way the system runs, I have to give you exams that effectively have the same degree of difficulty. I'm a really swell guy, but I cannot do that. I don't know how to do that. It's not practical. So you're gonna maybe consider one exam easy, maybe consider another one really hard. And I will not, you know, I'll do my best to make them even, but I know for a fact that sometimes that doesn't happen. So because of that, I have to normalize that out of the system. And the way that I'm going to do that is I'm going to take the mean of each of these exams, no matter what it is. It will be below 100, okay? Could be 70, could be 60. 65 to 70 is sort of typical for means for me because that allows me to evaluate the upper end and the lower end of capability of performance on the exam in class. I will take the mean and I will move that distribution to where the mean is at 100 for each of the exams. So one could be down at 40 and it goes up to 100. One could be at 70 and it goes to 100. So the mean will be centered at the same number for each. So this effectively, so first order scales out the differences in difficulty, okay? And then I do the numerical calculation of your averages, and that gives me the common curve for the course, and it's on that that I place letter grades. Okay? Now, that last bit is, okay, I get to do that, that's what I get paid for. Generally speaking, my curves are easier than you'll find in organic chemistry, at least in my experience. So, okay. And I'll pretty much, I don't have a quota system, I will pretty much, if the class is sort of what's normal for me, the mean will pretty much be at a B with a fairly wide B range, okay? If the class is anomalously good, I will slide the distribution up and the mean will be higher. If the class is anomalously bad, I'll slide it down a little, okay? So that's sort of how it works. There is a lab in the course. You need to do it. It has nothing to do with lecture, unfortunately, really. I mean, same topics, but we don't really synchronize it, and I don't want to. So you'll want to contact the lab people that have difficulties there, and only me in a last resort. There will be problems. Well, I guess let me talk about that later. Okay. I did find one error on the syllabus. I have to travel a couple of weeks during the term, and the way that we'll handle that is I will put PDF slides and an MP3 audio file on the web, and you need to go through those and listen to the lecture. It usually works out okay. It's a little bit boring because I may be in some hotel in Japan talking to myself in a room, and it's hard to make that entertaining. So sorry for that. But it usually works okay. There is one of these days, though, where I've scheduled an exam while I'm gone, and so there will be no class that day, but you will want to come here for the exam, so it will be during class time. And on the syllabus that I sent you the other day, this 25 was October 2, and there is a class on October 2, but not on the 25th. That's when you have your exam. So I've updated this on the web, on the class website, and I will eventually get it also on Blackboard. There's a lot of support for this class. I do have an office hour. I tried to explain the syllabus. I travel a lot. It's not practical for me to have lots of office hours because things just change too much. So what I do is I schedule one and I'll try to be around then if I'm in town. Okay, that's not a problem. You are welcome to walk in or email me and try to set up another time. And I will try to do that. If you walk in and I'm busy with other stuff, I may have to cut you off and we'll set up a time. That said, the TAs, we have 5 of them. I'll ask them to set up office hours. The Society of Physics students, we have very talented physics majors here. They tend to run help sessions in the physics and astronomy library in the evenings, and they love nothing more than to have 113 students come in and ask questions. They actually enjoy it. So you should take advantage of that. The main structural place where we're going to be, where I'm going to give you help is something called workshop. How many of you have workshops in chemistry here? Okay, so it'll be very similar here in physics. And I feel very strongly about this idea of workshop. I said these are small groups. You want to work together on doing the workshop problems that I hand out. If the TA starts answering questions for you too much, the thing is actually broken. That's not how it works. You need to work together to figure out what's going on and then whether or not you believe it. The TA's job is really just to facilitate you doing that and to make sure you don't get too far off track. Okay? But my instructions to the TA is if you sit down with the workshop module and then you're all looking at the TA, expecting the TA to stand up there and do the work, that they're just to go get some coffee. Okay? That's not how it works. So the idea is you will have problem sets that where I want you to practice more doing things on your own, okay? But in workshop, the focus is more how does one go about doing these types of problems? How did you know how to set it up that way? How did you know this piece of the problem ties into that piece of the problem? And then when you get the answer and stuff, how do you know that's the right answer? So these are the kinds of things that I want you to focus on in workshop. It really does work. My first time I taught Physics 114, I ran a split class because it was a new format for me. And I assigned 41 students to workshops and 110 were assigned to recitations, which were larger, and TA basically get there ready to answer questions for everybody. And at the end of the class, I was fairly stunned. If I looked at the students who made B minus or better, if they went to most of the workshops, which is most of this 41, it was 93% of the students. And if I looked at those who had been in recitations, it was 63% of the students. That's a stunning difference. So I adopted this format and went full-bore workshops. And because I didn't have a split class, I don't really have a control group for this, but I have found that in successive years, for courses that are not so different from this, and one that's supposed to be identical to it, you can see the difference in the grades between students who went to over half the workshops and those who went to less than half the workshops. There is a correlation. Students who go to more of them may have taken the course more seriously to begin with. But nevertheless, this is rather consistent with the other numbers that it showed. And there are numbers in biology and chemistry that basically also support this. So I'm a huge proponent for workshop. If you're not going to workshop and you're not doing it, then I don't actually think you're very serious about doing well in this class. So much so that when I am through and I make the final grade distribution for this class, I'll put on grade point lines, and whether any of you like it or not, there are going to be many of you that are going to be exactly 1 point beneath a grade point boundary. If you have gone to over half the workshops, I will bump you over that grade point boundary. If you haven't, then I assume you weren't too serious about the class, and I won't. Okay? And that's the only way that workshops become part of your evaluation, other than helping you understand how to do things and allow you to do better on these things. I'm not asking the TAs to evaluate you. And it's not required that you go. That's the only way of teaching. Okay, so I do have some advice for you. I do think that many of the things I have to say are useful, so I think you should come to class. The text will repeat some of those things, but it will generally say it in a different way because I won't read the text before I figure out what I'm saying to you for the day. I may read some other text, but I actually deliberately won't read yours, although I may check notation or something. I think doing the problem sets, and I say the right way, which means don't focus on getting the answer. I will take up problem sets from you because you need to stay up with the class. We're not going to grade them and hand them back to you in the way that you may think of in a physics class, typically. What we'll do is look at them, we'll pick one of the problems, and then grade it for effort. That is, I want to see that you put in some effort to try it. If you got it right, great. If you flailed about and didn't quite get it, fine. I'm going to put a solution set, a publisher's solution manual to the mechanics problems in the PAS library. If you struggle with a problem and you're having issues with it, talk to the physics majors up there, talk to me, talk to a TA, talk to your friends, go look at the solutions and figure it out. All of that is okay. Oh man. Sorry. Okay. My computer, some idiot up here didn't plug it in. Go figure. All right, it'll come back. Miracles do happen. Okay. Hello. Okay. I hope it thinks it's plugged in. And now this doesn't work. Okay. Oh, we're wasting time. Oh, that's fine. No, that's not why. Okay, I give up. Anyway, so work on the homework problems and try to come to closure on each of the problems. Do not desperately go and copy the problems out of the solution manual. You get nothing out of that. My instructions to the TAs will be, if they see something that's like what's in the solution manual, you get no credit for that one, okay? But it will be a percent for each of these problem sets. There'll be 9%. You'll have about 12 problem sets, which means you basically have 3 built-in drops there too. I understand you have other classes and you'll have to not do that, but I'm trying to make sure you stay up. Then I'm going to hand out solutions to these exams, to these problem sets, and your job isn't done when you hand it in. In fact, the fun starts when the solutions, you should look very carefully at what you're thinking and the solution and make sure you really understand the difference, if there are differences. Sometimes you might both be right, okay, there are different ways to solve these problems, and sometimes it really means you really misunderstand something, and that's your clue that you have to pick up on and fix it. Then you can ask questions and stuff of whoever, but straighten it out, and that's your responsibility, okay? It is probably a good idea to sort of keep track of your problems that hand them in. I cannot guarantee that they will be handed back really fast. So if you want it back fast, you ought to make a copy of it before you hand it in. Okay? I hope it'll come back time, and we're going to try to do that, but there'll be weeks when that'll be hard, because 4 of my TAs might have the same exams that they have. So go to workshop, participate in workshop, try to do the problem sets the right way, try to keep up, don't cram, as I mentioned. If you really sense impending doom, it's a good idea to talk to me then, or I will put on the web, actually it's already there, an online troubleshooting guide. I mean, I found I was saying the same sets of I was asking the same diagnostic questions of students who were coming to tell me they didn't do so well in exam 2, and I thought I studied, can you tell me why? And so I found I actually was asking any of the same questions, and depending on their answers, I was doing these branch points in my thinking and advice. And so I just put that in writing and put it on the web. So you may find that useful, okay? But if you really sense impending doom, it is better to talk to me earlier and get whatever advice I have for you then it is to wait until the day before the final, which does happen. Okay, so this is heartfelt advice. If you really have to pick and choose, then the really important ones and the key to post-physics nirvana is do the problem sets the right way, do workshops, and don't cram. Make sure you're squared away on Blackboard. Workshops will begin the week of September 10th. You will get an email that tells you when labs start, but it's not going to be next week. I have asked that you all get these little devices for the clickers, and But coming in a box like this, and they've changed it. I'm going to have to play with it before I even know how to use it, but we'll figure it out together. So hopefully you get those, and those will actually help us a lot in class. It'll make it more entertaining and help all of us understand when we are understanding things or not. I will be posting Problem Set 1 sometime soon. If you're lucky, I might get it up before the weekend in case you get bored. You guys are a little uptight. Okay. Labs start. Yeah, so email PhysLabs if you have real issues with the lab. Okay, so there's that. Do you have any questions on the course and how it's being run? Evaluated, whatever. Yes? I would only buy the clicker in the school store because they should have the one that is technologically compatible with what we thought. And in principle, they have a deal where you can buy it and use it for multiple classes and sell them back. I'm aware that some of you may have already had one for a different class and they just changed the technology and they're not going to take that one back or something. I don't know. I'm not in the midst of that, but... Anything else? Yes?
When does lab start?
You'll get an email. I don't know. I mean, it'll be in a couple of weeks, but I don't remember. I mean, nobody's told me yet. I just want to hear it. Yeah.
Can you kind of go up to the work stuff? You know, the work sets, labs or workshops?
Okay, do you hand in the problem sets in class or in workshop? I'm going to ask that you hand in the problem sets basically at the end of Thursday classes. So the bulk of them will show up here. That said, I may have said in the syllabus that you wanted to hand it in and you didn't bring it here and you wanted to get it in. If you got it underneath my door in my mailbox by, you know, Friday morning when I come in, that's fine. Probably I may change that, and there's a locker down on the bottom floor of the physics gun. I ask you to just put it in there if it's coming in late. So effectively you probably have it till Friday morning early if you wanted to.
Yes.
Do you
recommend getting the study guide and
solutions manual? So the question is, would I recommend getting the study guide and solutions manual? There will be a solutions manual on reserve in the BAS library, and you're welcome to use that judiciously. I don't really know about the study guide, and you're welcome to, you should page through it and see if you think it'd be helpful for you. I mean, I'm sure that for some of you it might be exactly the cat's meow, and for others not. I don't know. Revisit it. Whatever speaks to you. You may find another textbook, and some of the ones I have on reserve are textbooks that are decent, that are not so different. As long as it's a calc-based textbook and isn't at too high a level, you may find it speaks to you better than Jane Coley. I think Jane Coley is a pretty decent one, but you may find a different one works better for you. You still need Jane Coley if you want to refer to the actual problems that we use, although there should be Jane Coley up in the library, and you can actually look and go get the problems there. But I imagine that would be a pain doing that 12 times during the semester. Yes?
Do you know how many labs
Do I know how many labs there will be throughout the semester? I believe there's something on the order of 5 or 6. So it's like every other week. Actually plug. Sorry. I only use this particular laptop when I'm lecturing in here. It's a nice tablet. But since I was on leave last year, I haven't touched it for a year and a half, so it's a little cranky. Okay, so physics is science. It's more quantitative than most of them. So let me ask you, an audience full of scientists, what is science?
Yeah. The study of the world around you.
Study of the world around you. Any other opinion? Thoughts? Open mind. You're my friend. Study of the world around you. What characterizes science? Okay, now let me go back. So it's the study of the world around you. Are there other endeavors that people do where you might argue it's studying the world around you, trying to understand the world around you? What kind of other things might you think of? Other friends on the hall and their majors. You ever run across somebody who's really serious about their religion? Had a little too much coffee and started talking about God. You know, it's a way of trying to understand the world around you, right? Some artists, why do you do what you do? I'm really trying to understand the world around you, right? Many artists are giving you insight into things in their way. So what distinguishes science from these other endeavors?
Observing natural laws.
Observing natural laws, the scientific method. So what is the scientific method? I think I heard you, yeah.
Explaining natural phenomena through empirical observation.
Okay. So we keep coming down to empirical observation. And that's the thing that sets, yes?
I would say using hypotheses and then to set up tests and to looking for support.
Okay, so setting up hypotheses, looking for tests, to refute, support hypotheses. Yes?
I think science as a whole is a tool to help you find yourself backward, prove yourself wrong, just to learn the truth.
Okay, so science is a tool to help you learn the truth about the world around you. Okay, so I think we've got a lot here to talk about. There is at the core of science observation, just looking at the phenomenon, whatever it is, right? But science is a bit more than that, right? Science is also sort of creating hypotheses and then trying to see if they are supported or refuted by what you observe and then modifying those, okay, as you go along. So it's a bit of a stumbling, frustrating thing. And I would argue that, in fact, science has absolutely nothing to do with truth. Name one thing that is a scientific truth that could not be refuted if you found an observation that was in disagreement with it. That is at its core the difference between religion and science. Okay? And in many ways, I don't think religion and science are in conflict because of that difference. And where they go in conflict is when people confuse that difference. Okay? There is no such thing as a scientific truth. Okay? That said, there are lots of things that are so well documented empirically and through so many different experiments in so many different ways, and have been so stable through so many models of whatever it is that we're doing, that it's very easy to think of them as true. And one should pause greatly if you observe something that refutes them. You should work very hard to see if the experiment is correct. So, generally speaking, if you see something in an experiment that is unbelievable, it probably is wrong. So you work very hard to convince yourself. That said, every scientific revolution comes about when the unbelievable turns out to be true and you overthrow some truth that you thought existed, right? So, these things happen. A year ago, an experiment reported that neutrinos go faster than the speed of light. Most physicists were not very excited by that, because we knew that they probably did something wrong in their experiment. They worked very hard. That was actually a very valid experiment. It was a good report. Turns out, eventually they discovered a loose connection in one of their electronic devices that gave them the incorrect answer. Okay? So, it was unlikely to be true. But nevertheless, had people worked really hard and other experiments duplicated it, we'd be living in a pretty wacky place right now, because that would have overthrown causality and everything that underlies science would have sort of been thrown on its head. It would have been pretty fun. So, anyway, science is not about truths. But it is about observation. And physics is very much about observation, you know, observing nature and looking at it and trying to quantify that insofar as we can. And this is what drives the nature of physics as a whole. We're trying to be as quantitative as we can. So let me ask you, since we're now going to talk about measuring things and stuff like that, what really is the human experience? When at the core of it, what kinds of things can you actually measure? And what is it that is at the core of your human experience? You might look at something and measure it in terms of time. What is your experience in terms of time? How short a time can you imagine? Can you imagine a second? Maybe a tenth of a second? Have you ever watched a swimming race where the winner won by a hundredth of a second? So you can sort of imagine that. Do you have a sense of a microsecond? Do you measure things in microseconds, really? Not really. So maybe a millisecond might be the limit. How about on the upper side? By the way, if you're not into, you know, powers of scientific notation and units, you want to get scientific notation, you want to get real good at that. And metric units, I'm hoping you're all pretty good at that. So what about on the upper side of time? What's a reasonable number for the human experience? Lifetimes are give or take 22,000 days. Sort of sounds bad when you do it that way, right? 70 years, 75 years, something like that, on average. Hopefully for you all, eating well, exercising a lot, and being 80. Given what I've done in my life, I'll probably be 74. I know, probably 64. But I told you I wasn't going to tell you about that anymore. So on the upper side, the lifetime is, you know, in the 70-ish years, 100 years maybe, it's easy to imagine. We get used to talking about history, and it's pretty easy to sort of imagine hundreds of years, perhaps. Maybe get used to things. But once I start to lose a feeling for thousands of years, you know, I was in European history minor and doing Rome stuff, and it was a very cool story, but it's still, it's hard to imagine. But anyway, we can say maybe hundreds of years. So what about distance? What do you think? How small a thing can you sort of imagine? We're going to institute a new rule here, and that's going to be, you're going to come in, there's going to be espresso machine there, and a bar over here. And it's either a shot of espresso or a shot of tequila before you come into class. Then we're going to get some talking. So what do you think? How small a thing do you sort of conceive? Yeah. Nanometer. Ooh, that's small. Okay, that's hard for me to imagine, but you're used to microscopes and stuff. Yeah, so certainly micrometers, micrometers, you can imagine the size of a virus is somewhere in there, right? Okay. How about how big? The Earth, but, you know, from here to San Francisco is 2,500 miles, I guess. Circumference of the Earth is about 25,000 miles. Start flying to Japan or some, and you'll begin to realize how big that is. Earth-Sun distance, it was 93 million miles. Take light 8 minutes to get to it from the Sun. So, I don't know. I sort of think the size of the Earth is about okay, so 10 to the minus 9 meters to something like 25,000 miles. It's sort of a human experience sort of thing. How about mass? You've done a lot of chemistry, so milligrams is pretty easy to imagine. Micrograms, okay, maybe. Nanograms is starting to be a little small unless you're doing some instruments, but let's say 10 to the minus 6 grams. How about big? Certainly many tons. 100 tons. There we go. My friend did some tequila before he came. No. Okay, so 100 tons. So how about that? So that's sort of the human experience. But now if we go and we look at the world around us, it turns out it's a good bit richer than the human experience. So in terms of length, okay, we actually have measured things. At the LHC, we measure things that have distance scales on the order of 10 to the minus 18 meters. Okay, the proton itself is about 10 to the minus 15 meters. Hydrogen atom, 10 to the minus 10, right? Paper, 10 to the minus 4 meters. People are here, and we're talking about our sort of perception running from sort of the size of the Earth down to something on the order a little bit larger than the wavelength of blue light. Right? So it's a little range in here, but there's much more that we've actually measured. In time, similarly, the human experience is sort of right in here. Sort of right here. But there are relevant things that we measure very well that go much shorter. We've measured many top quarks now that live for less than 10 to the minus 25 seconds. The age of the universe is on the order of 13.6 billion years. For mass, we have again a small range in here, and yet we're measuring things down to extremely small masses and very large masses. So the human experience is really a fairly small piece of what you see in the universe around us. So one of the messages I have for you is that, let me ask you, do you think that this limited region of human experience bias is your way of looking at the universe at all? In fact, you probably designed such that certain things sort of make sense to you because you have to survive in a world that is in that limited range. And there are biological examples. I forgot, I thought I'd pull the slide. But if you look at the resolution in eyes for different animals and bugs as a function of their height, you will find that the taller animals have better resolution. Right? If you're a bug and you're down at the ground and your food is as big as you are, you don't need very good eyesight. But if you're a human and you have to reach down to pick up bugs to eat, you have to have pretty good eyesight. So if you look, there's actually a pretty nice correlation there. Okay? And in that sense, we're sort of designed to survive in the world in which we live. Okay. So one message to you is that one of the things we have to overcome in science is the human bias. And you can't really get rid of it because you will always have preconceived notions of what's right or wrong, especially when you have a strongly developed set of hypotheses that you have somehow bent in such a way that they make sense to you and they support a lot of the data that you thought about. Okay? Then when you see something that doesn't quite fit, you have to confront this. And sometimes you're forming your own bias when you're looking at these things. It has limited us in many ways. The world as we know it looks very different if you allow things to move very fast, that is, large distances in short times. We believe in a universe where we have three immutable spatial dimensions moving through time, right, at a fixed rate in one direction. If you start looking at things where you ask, what does a particular observation look like to someone who is moving past it at 90% the speed of light, you will find that, in fact, our entire concept of space and time is just wrong. Okay? And it absolutely boggles the mind, and it goes totally against human bias. And I would probably spend the last day of the semester, if I can, I'll try to talk to you about special relativity and do that. Another thing is quantum mechanics. I think many of you have run into this before, but when you're in chemistry, for example, you have to deal with the fact that light acts like particles, and particles act like waves, and the whole model of the atom is built on the wave mechanics of electrons, it's assuming this particle has wave characteristics, and then doing the math that allows that to happen. So that is what our atomic model is, okay? And yet, it boggles the mind. Waves and particles are very different things. Okay, so it goes against your perception. So human bias totally fails us in some ways. So that's one message. The other message is that even in the realm where you are very comfortable with your human bias, your human intuition can be misleading. Okay, and that is the thing that may plague you this semester and that we'll be fighting. I have here an ordinary bicycle pump. Okay? And it's a physical device with the weight mostly centered at the middle. And if I take a rope and hook it here, I can support it with the rope, I can support it with my finger, and what's going to happen if I let go with my finger? It's going to drop. How about that? You have phenomenal human intuition. I think that that's really great. Now, I'm going to do something a little bit different. I'm going to take exactly the same device, and I'm going to spin it up. Where it's going very fast. Now I'm going to let go. Okay. We're going to learn why that happens the way it does. It's not really Harry Potter. I wish I could do things like that. But you'll find that it defies sort of, it doesn't make any sense. So it turns out that human intuition is insufficient to really understand the world around us. We have to develop an infrastructure of very carefully set laws and rules and mathematical relationships to sort of make sense of things at a level that goes beyond what we initially would think. Okay, so we have to develop that whole set, way of looking at things. And it turns out that the English language is not sufficient to do this, so we use mathematics, which is the best language we have for this kind of thing. And we'll have to develop some strange mathematical tools in order to describe things very well. And you will see a mathematical equation that will tell you about exactly what happened, while your mind will be sitting there going, but that doesn't work. But you'll see it in the math. Okay, so there's a reason why we use math and physics, even though it's a barrier also, right? I mean, it's not the only field that does this, right? The other reason we use math and quantitative analysis is that it's the very nature of science. If I wanted to imagine I have a tennis ball and I put it here, and I want to write a scientific paper about what I observed, right? I can't just say, I saw a tennis ball in front of Hoyt. I have to say, I saw a spherical object with radius whatever, with the color whatever, and it was sitting in a GPS location whatever, and it had a shape just like this. The radius actually was, you know, this much plus or minus that much. Because I have to be able to then write this horrible paper and send it out there and have somebody else actually duplicate or look for their own tennis ball, right? And they have to know, is that the same beast or not? But that means the writing is absolutely horrible, because you have to give all that detail. But it's also true that you might have to be very mathematical about it, right? If I want to describe where that tennis ball is, what am I going to do? I have to define it with respect to something. We have to agree on what that is. I have to define the units. I mean, if I use furlongs, is that going to help you? Right? So I might define it with respect to that corner of voice. I might define the height of it at the sea level. I mean, I don't know. But it becomes very complicated to try to actually define things very carefully and precisely in science. And it gives us a lot of baggage, right? And this is sort of why we get the reputation that we do amongst your humanities friends. I mean, seriously, sit down and read the abstract of a few of your bio papers. And I'm a director of undergraduate research, so when people submit abstracts to go give talks in places, sometimes from the bio department, I read these and I'm just like, what? I mean, I can't do that. And I'm a scientist, right? I'm not that type of scientist. But, you know, I think about it, we can't even read our own abstracts. So science is pretty awful that way. At any rate, so the message here is that human intuition can fail you, so you should not rely upon it completely when you are doing physics. Don't read a problem and look at the picture and tell me what you think is going to happen. Because what you need to do is to be very, we're going to have an infrastructure for how to do the problems, and you need to be very careful in following that infrastructure. And I mean, I hate to use the word, but you need to be very anal about it. Because if you're not, you'll get into trouble. The reason for this is many things are sort of deceptive. And you all carry preconceptions about the world that you may not really realize until you stop and think about it. Physics is sort of designed to get at the core of those to try to ferret out what's really going on. So what you'll have to do is break some of your preconceptions and then form a new intuition about something. Okay, and the period during this class where a lot of that happens is during the Newton's law piece, which is why the mean drops like a rock during that period, if I get an exam before or after. Sorry. So you want to be sure to let yourself be very systematic about studying those things at that time. That said, your common sense is actually a very useful sort of thing. By the way, I will typically post slides that we use in class. I'll annotate them and probably fill in some of what we've discussed, okay? And then I'll post them on the web. In addition, typically, especially if I remember to bring it, I will also make an MP3 recording of the class, and I will put that on the web, just so you know that that will be there. And if you miss a class, that's your first thing to do, is to go look at that stuff and see. Your intuition can be very important. So one of the things you need to do is to ask yourself when you're doing a problem whether it makes any sense when you look at the solution, or even if the problem itself makes any sense. I remember once when I was grading a problem as a TA at Columbia when I was in graduate school, and I remember it was a problem that required the student to calculate something for the mass of the baseball. And I looked at the number the student had, and I realized it was larger than the mass of Jupiter. Did you think about this number at all? Right, so you can use some common sense to sort of figure some of this stuff out. And you can even estimate a lot of the things that you need to estimate in order to see if what you're doing makes any sense whatsoever, if it's in the ballpark. So one of the things that you want to do sometimes is perhaps to estimate things to see if you have any sense of it. So let's ask a question. And it's not fair to ask Mr. Google. How many birds are in New York State? Suppose I put that on the exam. I don't mean to the nearest one, right? Can you get it to within a factor of 10 or 50? How would you start estimating this? What would you do?
Try to figure how many human beings are in the state.
Would that correlate with or against the number of birds?
I'd put into a ratio, like for every human being, say there's 25 birds.
Okay, that's an interesting way to think about it. Yeah?
Trying to figure out the average population density of most bird species in New York.
Okay, and how would you do that?
Observation.
So you'd go outside and look. All right, so I don't know, but the estimates are something that you need to do in your careers a lot, and I don't know, you could try different things. The idea of taking a number that you may know, which might be a population of New York, and somehow trying to correlate that with population of birds might make some sense. Let's suppose New York looked something like this. Oh, I love New York. Yes. Sorry. Okay, I'll do that. So we have Western New York, then we go up here, and then we go down to... Okay. All right. So let us suppose... Let's just start from... Suppose you were in a spot of land that was about like the size of a football field. How many birds would you see? Well, assuming you don't have some anomalous flock passing through, right? Do we count Canadian geese as birds?
Huh? Five.
Five? Okay. So let's say there are five birds per football field. And then I don't know the size of New York State, but why don't we do it this way? I know that it takes about, I don't know, 6 hours to drive from here to here at something like 70 miles per hour. Right? And probably, I don't know, 5 hours this way. It looks sort of like a triangle, so we could calculate the distance this way, distance that way, multiply them together and divide by 2 to get a total area, then divide by the number of football fields you can fit in that area. So you sort of get a sense of it. So then you can take 5 birds per football field and multiply it by that ratio of areas, and boom, you've got a number. And it's not going to be perfect. But I bet it's not really a factor of 100 off, right? Maybe a factor of 10. So that's sort of the way to estimate. You know a lot more than you think you know. You have to let yourself play that game sometimes to sort of figure out whether what you're doing makes any sense at all. The other thing that comes out of this is you do have to worry about units and things. So we'll talk a lot about those. I could do a lot more, but maybe I won't. Do you have any other questions about how the class is going to work? So we're going to jump into physics proper next Tuesday a bit more. And I'll see you then.